Accession number 8234, rule number 5.
Colonel Draffen, rule 5. You're telling me that the South Africans evacuated their pilot despite the order to the contrary.
Yes. I then was beginning to walk. The Norwegian sister bound the whole of my tummy up with the most enormous plaster, yards and yards of plaster around my tummy to keep in my hernia, which I developed. And I then went into Addis and found two South African trucks, a captain and two South African staff sergeants going back to Nairobi in 2 one-ton trucks. So I got a lift in the remaining seat. And I just told the CO in the hospital that I was going to leave him. And I said, I want a couple of blankets. And he gave me two blankets and said that I would hear no more about it. And I just disappeared, and I got back to Nairobi by road from Addis, which took me 13 days.
How long was it before you were able to return to the battalion?
Well, this was in May, and I had to go into hospital in Nairobi, and then they gave me 2 months sick leave, and I got back just before Christmas.
And where was the battalion at that time?
A place called Jimma. The remainder of their activities through the lakes consisted of a lot of smaller skirmishes until they got to the Omo River, which was, I gather, quite something. It was well defended, and the road went down an escarpment which was blown by the Italians, and it was really a well-defended and solid position. It took them about 2 days to push the Italians out, and then up to Jimma, where they formed a base and had a very enjoyable few months. In fact, we had all the Duke of Aosta's horses, all 52 of them, until the brigadier came to inspect us, and he saw the stables, and he took half of them back to Addis with him.
What did you do then once you got back to the battalion?
Again took over as adjutant, and then we moved back by road to Lake Rudolph in the north of Kenya, and formed a camp at a place called Lodwa and Todenyang on the lake. And from there we sent our transport in to Kitale, and we collected our shattered wits and had rather an enjoyable time, actually, because the lake was very beautiful. There were a lot of crocs in it, but lots of fish and very good food, and everybody had a rest.
What state was the battalion in then when it came out of Abyssinia?
Oh, terrific morale. We'd had a wonderful time. We really had boosted their morale. We had sports and terrific fun in Jimma. We organised paper chases and polo and horse racing. We had the most terrific time, and all the askaris joined in, and we had good canteens and this sort of thing, and their morale was right up.
And what strength were they at?
Oh, full establishment strength. We got our replacements at Jimma for our losses over the campaign.
And they'd been absorbed in, had they?
Yes, they'd all been absorbed back into the battalion.
Where did you go then after Lake Rudolph?
Well, we went back to Kitale and handed in our transport with the transport people were by then getting rather sophisticated and told us that we shouldn't have Chev lorries with Ford carburettors. So we thought we'd been rather clever in getting them all the way around Abyssinia in that condition. But and then we went to a place called Yatta, where we were training and re-equipping with a view to going over to Madagascar. And during this time, there was a Somali battalion. They had recruited a complete Somali battalion who went berserk and started firing mortar shells into the 1st Battalion's lines and firing rifles. There were very, very few Europeans in camp at that time because everyone was on leave. I, as adjutant, was the senior man in the battalion. And the acting brigade commander, who was my own CO, said, well, you must take your battalion into the lines and disarm the Somalis. Well, I had three company sergeant majors Somali, and the RSM was a Somali. So I got hold of them and I asked them, told them what we were going to do, and I said, you're going in to disarm your brothers. Are you quite happy? And they said, yes, of course we are. And it went very successfully.
Did they resist being disarmed?
Not a bit, no, because we sent the Somalis in first.
Do you know why it was they'd started shooting at the other?
I think they just had a what they call in East Africa fatina, just an argument amongst each other with the tribes on the in the other battalions. Mm. And somebody didn't like somebody else. And they had no respect or appreciation of what a mortar or a rifle could do, really. I mean, they fired them all right, but they hadn't been on the receiving end, so they didn't really know.
And what happened to the Somali battalion?
Well, we disarmed them, and then we were given the terrible task of bringing them to heel, which meant, as far as we were concerned, taking them on 25-mile route marches in the heat in the desert. It didn't do them or us any harm, I suppose. And we got their spirits back, and then I think they were disbanded. We left after that and went over to Madagascar.
When did you first hear that you were going to Madagascar?
Not until very shortly before we left Yatta. And this, of course, was the first time the Askari had ever been on the sea, in fact, even seen the sea. And to show you their mentality, I was standing at the rail by my orderly, and he suddenly said, look, Bwana, all the houses are moving. So I said, no, they're not. If you look over there, there's a little boat with a tow rope and it's pulling us out from the quayside. And I said, there's one at the back. And they're pulling us out. When we get in the middle of this big area, we'll start up our own engines and we'll go under our own steam. But he never believed me. He reckoned that we stood still and the world moved round us, and nothing I could say would dissuade him.
Were they at all alarmed about going on the sea?
Not a bit. No, they showed no emotion. They were very poor sailors, though. And they didn't like it much.
How long did the voyage take?
I honestly don't remember. About 3 days, something like that. They were all terribly sick, and we had frightful time because they didn't want to come up onto deck. But we eventually got them up, and they sorted themselves out before we got to Madagascar. We went straight to Diego Suarez, which had been taken by a British brigade under Brigadier Festing. And they were very good. And we just took over from a British unit, and we had a British commando unit stationed near us. And there we stayed for about 3 weeks while they evolved the plan to take the rest of Madagascar. And then we went, but during this period, we went off with our, to carry out the first combined operation ever undertaken with African troops to Mayotte, to take the governor and the police headquarters in Mayotte and in the Comores. And we had two rifle companies with my CO in command, section of divisional signals, our own mortar platoon, plus a a platoon of British commandos. And the British commandos were detailed to take the governor. We had the police barracks and various other places in the town of importance. And it was here that David Sheriff did so well. He led his company extremely well, and I think that was the occasion from which we put him in for an MC. The trip to Mayotte was a little difficult because they put us on a cruiser called the Dauntless and a frigate called the Foxhound, and they leapt about in the sea and we were all very ill. But once we got near the island, they gave the Ascaris, which I thought was rather wrong, a tot of rum, but it settled them down, or settled their tummies down, and we were all very happy, and away we went. And Captain Hamilton, in charge of the Dauntless, in command of the Dauntless, actually, against instructions, went over the coral reef into the harbour so that we could get a first-hand view of the operations, though of course they were all at dawn. They embarked into the landing craft at 3 a.m. and it was all over by dawn, but we got in.
Was there any resistance?
There was no resistance at all. The governor was found in bed with his mistress, and the police barracks, our Ascaris, got into them without the police waking up. And similarly, they got into the wireless station and they caught the chaps before they had time to break. There were the instructions hanging on the wall that everything was to be broken and hammers to do so, but not one thing was broken.
So it was a very successful coup de main.
Extremely successful.
What about the campaign to conquer the rest of Madagascar?
Well, then we went down in the most enormous convoy to, I'm not sure the name of the port, Majunga. Anyway, we went down to a port on the west coast opposite to Tananarive, and we landed there, but it was a little chaotic, a lot of this, because the whole operation had to be organised from Mombasa, and most of the troops were in Madagascar. And we went down to a place called Tuliá and landed there. They picked us up at Diego Suarez and then took Diego Suarez and took us right down to Tuliá, after which the brigade set off, and we were the last battalion. We stayed for ages, 3 or 4 days, while they were offloading ships. We just sat on the beach and bathed. And it was very difficult because the ships couldn't all get into the deep water quay. So all the disembarkation orders had to be reversed and altered to get the right lorries off and the right food off and the right ammunition off. And it took ages, but eventually we set off and we caught up with the battalion, with the brigade, and had one or two little skirmishes before we got to Tananarive. The campaign consisted almost entirely of the French building roadblocks, either of stone or chopped down trees or defended sangers. They even blew up the road in one or two places, but only two that I remember. And these took ages to remove because we got to get troops out on either side to defend the parties clearing the roadblock, and then they would be cleared, and on we'd go for another mile or two, only to find another one. And every 5 or 6 would be defended. And then you'd have to start a little battle. But as soon as we fanned out and approached the enemy, up went the white flags, and this became a little tedious.
How close did you have to get to them before they would put the white flags up?
Oh, a couple of hundred yards. They never gave you a chance.
They were just forcing you to deploy then, weren't
forcing
they?
Us wasting to deploy, time. Wasting time. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was a waste of time campaign. When the armistice was signed, it was very interesting because the French came out, all their regalia, with their kid gloves and swords and sashes and beautiful uniforms. Where they'd got them from, I don't know, but everything was done magnificently. And I asked the question afterwards, why did this campaign not cease quicker? And they said, entirely because after 6 months, we get a campaign medal. And this campaign lasted six months and one day.
Were there positions and roadblocks and so on well constructed? Did they do a good job on those?
Oh, yes, they were very well constructed. And when we got to just a place called Ansara Bay, where there was a battalion position, and we were told to attack it at dawn, this was after Tananarive. We then moved down south, down the centre of the island, along the top of the ridge of mountains which runs north and south on the island. And this position was a beautiful battalion position, well dug in, well organised, with good communications. And we were told to attack this at dawn, which we did. And it was a very misty, it was just like a Scotch mist, and visibility was poor. And I regret to say that as we approached, the order was given to fix bayonets when we saw the trenches in front of us. But up went the white flags. But I saw two chaps stuck with bayonets holding on to their white flags. We couldn't stop them. They'd had enough by this time.
Your soldiers got bored, had they?
They thought this wasn't cricket. And then we went into Ansara Bay, had a service in the church when we prayed for the wounded and the sick and the dead. And the next morning we attacked another battalion position at South Ambushed.
Did the same thing happen there?
No, they capitulated rather quicker in time. They got away. And then we went on down through Ansara Bay. Then we went down to Ambushed, and the armistice was signed at a place called, I forget it now, I forget the name of it, Ambalavia or some name like that.
What sort of troops were you up against in
Madagascar? French colonial troops, French officers and NCOs with Malagash troops. They were quite good. But the interesting thing was that all their troops from Madagascar were drawn from the tribes on the western coast, because from the Indian Ocean on the east, the rain all fell along the east coast, and life was too easy. The chap threw a seed into the ground and it grew, and he picked the fruit off and ate it, and he would not do any work whatsoever. We couldn't make him build a road. We couldn't make him do anything. He wouldn't help. On the west coast, they were absolutely marvellous. They were hungry. They were hardy. They were living. They were a little up against it, and they were great people. Same people in a different environment.
And how did you find the French once the fighting was over?
Oh, a little reticent. They were very nice, and we got on very well with them. We went back to Tananarive, and we had garrison barracks there, and it was really rather fun. But the French colonial system was so different from ours that it was a little difficult to understand. You see, there were lots of black French and khaki French, and it didn't matter. And until we had a ball, brigade threw a most tremendous ball when everybody came, from the mayor and corporation down to the dustman, I presume. And it was very interesting because all the white people arrived first, and then the khaki people, and then the black people. it was organised.
So there was an order of precedence.
Oh, yes. Mm. But they all lived next door to each other in the city.
What did your soldiers think of Madagascar?
Well, they didn't quite understand this mixed racialism. And there again, this is a thing that they began to come up against and they didn't really understand. And they, I think, got a few lessons which weren't too good for them. But you can't stop what we call progress.
So it disordered their view of the world, did it?
Oh, yes, yes.
When the French were actually fighting you, did they inflict many casualties when they were defending their roadblocks?
No. Only one or two askaris were killed, and it was mostly wounds of rather superficial nature.
Did they have any artillery to bring to bear?
Yes, they had some big guns, but they kept them so far back that they could only just fire a few hundred yards in front of their positions. And they didn't do an awful lot of damage. Though there were 65 pounders and we couldn't get anywhere near them.
What about your side? Did you have any guns in sport?
We had some a mountain battery with 25 pounders, and we had good guns. We had two batteries of 25 pounders, and we had a lot of fun with them. They gave us great support on play, especially when these dug-in positions where you had them on a hillside and we could fire our guns straight across the valley into these...
Direct fire.
Mm.
Do you think there are any general lessons to be drawn from your experience of the fighting in Abyssinia or Madagascar?
I think the most important thing that we learnt, and we learnt it very early on, though it was apparent in all three campaigns, that the soldiers, the askaris, are tremendous people, but like all soldiers, they must know what you think is going to happen. Giving information to the troops before a battle is half the battle. If they don't know what's going to happen, or you haven't thought of something that might happen, then they get confused. But normally speaking, if you give them as much information as you've got, and you do a little anticipation and say, well, they may have guns or they may have tanks, so if you hear a tank coming rumbling towards us, you'll know what it is, though they'd never seen a tank in their life, they were all right, and they stood firm, and they were grand soldiers, and I should say I'd be prepared to take them anywhere. But you must give them information, though I believe this applies to all of us, not just to the Askari.
So it is a general lesson rather than a specific one.
Oh, yes. One other piece of interesting sideline on information is that after Madagascar, when we were static and enjoying ourselves, one of the askaris who had been on leave came back, and very shortly afterwards we got a letter to say that he had run away with somebody's wife and that the tribe were very upset about it and that the district commissioner was having a case brought against him. But unbeknown to us and unbeknown to him, the tribe themselves brought in a witch doctor who put a curse on this boy. And one day he just left his company barracks and walked up the hill and sat down stark naked, and we could do nothing with him. He wouldn't listen to anybody. We did persuade him to have a blanket. The doctor said that he wasn't to be locked up. So there he was. He sat there for days and he wouldn't eat, but we did persuade him to drink. Well, the outcome was that fortunately we persuaded him in the end that he would t- take the wrap, return the woman, and pay the fine, on which we were advised that the witch doctor would withdraw the spell. But of course, he withdrew the spell before the letter advising us of this fact was received at our end. And one day he just walked back into camp saying, "I'm perfectly all right now, the spell's gone." And he put on his uniform and became a normal Askari again. Which was very interesting.
Sorcery was effective.
Yes. But it does have they believe in it and it works.